This is KBOO Portland. It's 11 a.m. and we're going to hear the radio zine next, right after this. So stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning. You are tuned into Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Jenny Yokoyama, your host for this morning. And over the next half hour, we are going to be looking at The Brothers Paranormal, which that music you just heard is from the original production with music there by Joe Kai. And The Brothers Paranormal is a play that is premiering tonight at Coho Production Space in Northwest Portland. And The Brothers Paranormal is a first-time co-production between Media Rights Theater Diaspora and Coho Productions. And here joining me in studio this morning is The Brothers Paranormal playwright Prince Gomulvilas, actor and producer Samson Siroth, and actress, Andrea White. Welcome to Radio Zine, The Brothers Paranormal.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jenna.
So, can we just get a quick synopsis? What is The Brothers Paranormal about?
Well, The Brothers Paranormal is about two Thai American brothers who launch a ghost hunting business in order to capitalize on the nationwide increase in sightings of Asian-looking ghosts. So they are called to investigate the home of an African-American couple who are being haunted by an Asian-looking ghost. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the plot.
When I first read the description of the play, I giggled a bit when I saw Asian-looking ghost put in quotes.
Yes.
and I wondered, well, what is an Asian-looking ghost? And what I thought in my head was that idea, you know, the person in all white with the hair in front. And then I saw your poster and I went, oh my goodness, this is going to be a scary moment.
Right. I mean, that's a very iconic image. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we know it here in the West as the girl from the ring, right?
Yeah.
But that image has been in Asia for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm. So Prince, your playwright, you wrote this play. And what year did you write? Or first start your stage readings on these and production.
I started writing the play in about 2011.
Okay.
And developed it in a writing workshop with Center Theater Group down in Los Angeles. And then over the course of 8 years, I've done stage readings and developmental workshops of this play all around the country. So I've had nearly, I would say, almost 10 kind of stage readings of this before all of a sudden this year, a whole bunch of theaters wanted to produce it around the same time. So it's been a long journey, but very, very gratifying now.
Wow. So talking about stage readings, actually here in Portland, that was one of the places that had a stage reading back in January of 2018, which, Samson, I know that you were a part of that. Can you talk a little bit about what that stage reading was back in 2018, which I know also Prince was here mm-hmm. for that whole process.
Yeah, it was a really great experience to have Prince here. We workshopped it a bit to see how the relations of each characters were with each other and how the storyline flowed and really the plot points and how they were, how they flowed together. It was a great experience to have the audience feedback. They really appreciated the representation, and that's really what we're about at Meteorites Theater Diaspora, is really representing authentically.
Can we talk a little bit about Meteorites Theater Diaspora? Maybe for our listeners who don't know what Meteorites Theater Diaspora is, can you talk a bit about what type of productions and what makes Meteorites Theater Diaspora different?
Sure. We focus on the authentic representation of Asian American playwrights, actors, and just really getting our voice out there, being represented the right way that we want to be represented. We started in about 2013 when Portland Center Stage was doing Chinglish by David Henry Hwang. And we did Dance in the Railroad. D-May Roberts, myself, communicated about creating this project under Meteorites. And so ever since then, we've been doing stage readings. We've been partnering with other community organizations and really just trying to come together. And we are so excited to bring this production, this co-production with Coho, to our audiences.
You can talk a little bit about that, about how did this collaboration of this co-production with Coho come about?
When we did this reading, this stage reading, it was it really stuck with us, and we knew that this is something that we wanted to produce fully. And when Coho opened up their process for picking co-producers, I definitely jumped at the chance. And when we applied, we had so many conversations with Philip Cuomo and the staff at Coho, and yeah, we really jived, and here we are now.
First time collaboration. This is exciting. Yeah. Exciting for the theater world here in Portland. And as Princess, you were talking about, you know, you've been working on this work for quite a while, and then all of a sudden in the last, like, you know, year, you are now having this rolling world premiere happening of The Brothers Paranormal. I don't know if many audiences know what a rolling world premiere is. Can you describe what that's been for your show here?
Well, there's an organization called the National New Play Network, which sort of has a formal infrastructure for rolling world premieres, which means a play will be performed during the course of a season or two at many different theaters across the country. So that's the idea of a rolling world premiere. This particular rolling premiere is actually accidental. So there is no infrastructure supporting this. It's just serendipity, or I don't know what it is. But all of a sudden, just everybody thought that this was the year that they wanted to do it. So it began with the world premiere at Pan Asian Rep in New York City earlier this year, and then a co-production in Minneapolis, St. Paul, between Penumbra Theater Company, which is one of the leading African-American companies in the United States, and Theater Mu, which is an Asian-American theater company, also earlier this year. And then last week, it just opened in Indianapolis at Fonseca Theater Company, which is a multicultural theater company. Opens tonight here in Portland. And then we'll open tomorrow in Seattle with Pork Filled Productions, which is an Asian-American theater company up there. So it is an accidental rolling world premiere.
And have you attended all the premieres, or are you able to see all the productions?
Yes, I've seen them all so far, and then I'm flying out tomorrow to see the opening in Seattle as well.
And so are you seeing, what are the differences that you're seeing between these different productions? Is it kind of surprising when you see these productions? Like, because I also wonder how involved you are with each of these premieres as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's so great to see different interpretations of the play and the characters. You know, theater is a very collaborative medium. That's why I love it so much. I love working with directors. I love working with designers and actors. And to see the different nuances that different actors bring to it, that different designers and directors bring to it, has been really great. The New York production, I was there for every rehearsal, so I was very involved in that because I was still rewriting the play, right? I do a lot of rewriting in the room, in the rehearsal room, so I was there for that entire process. In Minneapolis, St. Paul, I was there for maybe a few days at the beginning of the process and then sort of near the tail end of the process. And then I was able to come last night to come to the final preview and contribute a little bit there as well.
Well, we've been talking a lot about the kind of nuts and bolts of what's behind this production, but what we're going to see on stage, if you're able to get out there, is talking about, well, essentially it's a ghost story, right? But it's more than just a ghost story. From what I understand, it's also about healing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the play deals with it. The play is kind of traffics in multiple genres, which can be unusual to a lot of Western audiences, but it's not really unusual for Thai audiences or Asian audiences, right? So I always describe the play as a horror comedy drama. Right, so there's a lot of things going on. The play starts out very funny, it gets genuinely scary, and then it gets it could get kind of sad, perhaps. This is not unusual in Thailand. I mean, you see a lot of Thai movies where, you know, in one moment there's crazy, brutal, bloody action, and then the next moment there's like this nutty scatological humor, and the next moment it's like high family melodrama. And to Western audiences, it's like it causes us a kind of like intellectual whiplash. But I really wanted to play with that in this play. And then also, this theme of healing definitely comes in because the play not only deals with the very surface pleasures of the horror genre, but has deeper issues at play and in mind. And those are, you know, how people deal with loss and grief and things of that nature.
What they know at the heart of the story, at the plot, is Andre, your character, right, is someone who's now living in the Midwest because they've been displaced by Hurricane Katrina. So obviously at the part of that story is trauma and what it is to be displaced. Can you tell us a bit about your character and what this experience has been for you?
Delia is, she is a woman who feels incredibly deeply, and she has she has a sense of she has a sense of home with her at all times. She and Felix, her husband, there's something very special about New Orleans. It's its own culture, and she to be displaced from there and be in this completely new place, I think that there is a great sense of loss for she and Felix. Not just what they've lost, you know, as far as personal items and people, but just their sense of home. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I think that she carries with her, you know, always. But there's also this a fear of going back because there's a possibility of the catastrophe that was Katrina. Mm-hmm. And I actually went back to New Orleans 7 years after Katrina on a trip, and it was so fresh and full for the people that were there. It's something that will never go away, that destruction, that displacement. So that's what she carries with her as, you know, throughout the play.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like another thing, the word haunting really sticks with me because it's not only the haunting of a ghost, but the things that haunt you in life, like the past or
fear.
A lot of the play involves a lot of mental illness, especially in the communities of color, because they're not talked about very
Correct.
Often.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to really bring that up and have a conversation, it's really important.
Not to give away too much of the plot, but how is it that the discussions about mental health kind of get folded into this ghost story?
Well, I think that there is a question early on in the play of whether or not the ghosts that are being talked about in the play are actually real. So there is this question of what is real and what is not, what could be mental illness and what could not, what could be supernatural and what could not. So that is a question that is played with and a tension that is throughout the early part of the play, definitely.
Definitely such a real part of the experience of being in America, at least for me. So if you are just tuning in, you're listening to Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. And this morning, well, almost afternoon, we are talking about the play The Brothers Paranormal, which is having its premiere here in Portland tonight at Coho Productions in Northwest. And my guests here in studio with me are playwright Prince Gomavilas, actor and producer Samson Seeroth, and actress Andrea White. And we'll be back in just 1 minute, but let's hear a little bit more of that music from Shokai. Music from the play The Brothers Paranormal, original music there, written and performed by Portland artist Shokai. And from what I understand, Shokai will be performing live during one of the performances.
We do have a lot of special events with this production.
Okay.
For opening night tonight, we do have Shokai performing live, and also Prince will be discussing the show at our post-show discussion. On Halloween, October 31st, we have a trick-or-treat food drive for Oregon Food Bank. If you bring some cans of food, you get a free cookie, and ghost costumes are suggested, not mandatory. But and then on November 1st, we have our POC night for people of color. It's not exclusively people of color, but it is it's a chance for people of color to experience live theater with other people of color. On November 3rd, we have another post-show discussion on mental illness, and our special guests will be Koi Vu from the Asian Family Center, Leslie Gregory from Right to Health, and a representative from NAMI, the National Association on Mental Illness. On November 10th, we have another post-show discussion with the cast and creative team. And then on November 15th, we have an ASL interpreted performance for members of the deaf and hard of hearing community.
I want to see the ghost costume night just to be on, imagine just being on stage and then looking out.
And seeing another ghost.
That's kind of fun. So I just want to know, this is a ghost story, but you're also saying that, you know, it's more than just that. So I'm wondering, is this a family-friendly show if I were to bring children?
I think it's maybe 13 plus.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I saw the Amityville Horror when I was 6 or 7. So
did I.
Did you really?
My stepsister or half-sister took me, and I was frightened for years after that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I'm okay, I think.
It's definitely scary, though, because I know during our performances, there are moments where people are so scared they literally jump out of their seats.
Oh, goodness.
I'm scared and I'm in it, and I know what's going to happen. There are times.
We had a preview performance last night, and some people screamed, so that's great. I know that a production in the production of Minneapolis-St. Paul, there were nights where people would, during the scary parts, get up and run out of the theater.
Oh, wow.
As the playwright, does that feel good to watch people running out because it's so scary? Are you thinking, oh, success, or oh, goodness?
Yeah, I mean, I want people to feel a range of emotions in this play. So it is an emotional roller coaster.
Andrea Sampson, as the actors in this production, I'm kind of wondering, when you came into the play, Andrea, we will start with you. Did you have any sort of history with maybe the paranormal or feelings about the paranormal? And has this play kind of given you any thoughts around that topic?
Well, I tend to believe that most likely anything's possible. But I think I'm most interested in the haunting of the living characters. And quite honestly, it's written so beautifully that just the character-driven drama and their journey, that the fears that they have are actually equal to the fear of, you know, possibly having a ghost haunting your house. I mean, just the emotional journey that they go on. But yeah, so I believe that I have possibly seen some kind of entity at one time or another. Maybe. Might be my imagination. I don't know.
What about Samson for you? Has this been any sort of, learning experience or bringing yourself into this?
Oh, yeah. I think, well, I'm Thai. Or I'm not Thai. I'm, I'm actually part
We've
Thai.
Switched
I found
places.
Out.
Oh, really?
Through like a genetics test that I'm part Thai, actually.
Oh, you can claim
but,
it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm mostly Lao. But in our culture, it's very similar to Thai. But we also believe in like ancestral spirits, and we have spirit houses in our yard where we put food and things for our ancestors for when their spirits moving on. So I've always had this supernatural element in my life, so it's kind of nice to dive into a play that kind of delves into that.
Very curious. I'm so curious to see this show now. I'm going to try to go on POC night.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll show up on Halloween. Maybe I'll just show up to both nights so that I can. I want to be a ghost. I want to dress up. I'm going to admit it. I want to come on Halloween.
Speaking of POC night, I don't know if it's particularly clear to the listeners that this play actually exclusively, in terms of the characters, is populated by actors of color and characters of color, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen very often, and to have this intersection of race, the Asian American and the African American, is also very rare, and I really love this casual intersection of race where races can be represented and come together, and it's not necessarily about race relations or racism or anything like that. These are people just going through things together, right?
I just want to give an appreciation to you as the playwright for just that. As a actress of color, oftentimes when I am on stage, that is the central point of the entire play. And this play, we get to be people.
Yeah, and to see the relationship between your character, Andrea, her character's name is Delia, and her husband's character's name is Felix, and to see the love between those two is also very rare. I mean, depictions of black love, very rare. Yeah,
it's also multi-generational.
Yeah.
To see what the mother and how the son, who was born in America, how they interact, and then the brother, who is also from Thailand, and his interaction with his brother that was born in America, just the way that they interact, and to see the differences, it's really beautiful.
I'm gonna make a bold statement here and say, wow, it sounds like you wrote something that is authentic. that people of color have complex lives, have intersectionality within their lives, and that we are humans.
Humans who
have emotions, and like you're saying, love that is often not depicted in just sort of a way that, you know, we don't live in these bubbles, that we actually interact with one another, and that, you know, our existence is complex. And it's sad that is a revolutionary thing to see on stage still in 2019.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, as the playwright, how much of that was intentional choices of, oh, I'm going to have intersectionality versus I'm going to write something that is more just like everyday life. And then this is what came out. I'm curious.
I think it's the latter. I think it's more like, oh, this is my experience, and this is what I observe. Why am I not seeing what I observe in the world on stage mm-hmm. and wanting to do that, right? Because my world is populated by the intersection of race, right? When I grew up in the Midwest, I grew up in Indianapolis during a time when there were not a lot of Asians there. You know, you look at my old school photos and it's a bunch of white kids, a bunch of black kids, and then it's me, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's been my life since I was a kid. So it's like, okay, well, this is the natural kind of progression of that.
And Samson, Andrea, for you mentioned a bit, like, you know, what that's been like for as a cast to be in an all POC cast. What has that been like for you? Because I've been in maybe one, and it blew my mind. I think that was with you.
I
think that was the first time I was ever was in a POC cast was with you, and it was just like, Andrea, this is amazing.
It is. It's comfortable and lovely. I mean, not that I'm uncomfortable
with just
a cast of white people.
It's just a different experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not that it's to be better or worse, but that it's different.
It is. It is. I mean, I think we're all walking in the door, just walking into the rehearsal space or the performance space, having walked through the world with our individual experiences, yeah. but... especially being in Portland, very much common experiences yeah. of being a person of color. And there's a comfort in that and a familiarity, and I appreciate it deeply.
And I think there's a thinking of some kind of producers in the country that this kind of diversity doesn't necessarily sell, which is totally incorrect. I mean, just by observing, I mean, if you have eyes, you know that there is an interest in other cultures. And I mean, it's like, that's the reason why K-pop is so big. That's why we know what an Asian girl ghost looks mm-hmm. like, right? That's why Asian horror films are so popular.
And the other thing, too, is that there's so much familiarity in there's a scene with the character Max and his mother and their dynamic, and you know, I'm half black and I'm Jewish, and it could have been a scene with myself and my mother. It's important to have diverse people on stage so that people can see people that are not like them and find those connections, and I think there's a lot of room for that in this play.
Yeah, Prince, you were mentioning how producers don't really believe that plays with POC central casts are as successful. But really, I think what Theater Diaspora does is we really help change the demographic of the audiences and bring in new people who aren't necessarily theater goers. Mm. I mean, last night we had the Immigrant Refugee Community Organization bring in 40 people?
Dozens of people, yeah.
Yeah, and for many of them, it was their first time seeing a live theater production, and they were so engaged. It was amazing.
It was a delight to perform for that audience.
Yeah, and with our demographics in Theater Diaspora are well over, 50%? More than 50%. And I think co-productions like this, being able to work with other organizations is really going to help change the faces of the audiences.
You know, we're almost out of time, and I want to make sure that our audiences get all the info if they're interested in seeing The Brothers Paranormal. So it's premiering tonight, and can you give us all the dates? How long is your run? What are the times?
So it is October 25th. Today is our opening night, and we run until November 16th. The times are 7:30 Thursday through Saturday, and then we have 2 p.m. matinees on Sundays. And to get tickets, you can go to cohoproductions.org, and you can also find out more information about Media Rights and Theater Diaspora at Media Rights, that's MediaRights.org, and TheaterDiaspora.org, that's theater with an R-E. We also have a special POC discount, that's BPPOC. The letters BPPOC that you enter during checkout, and that's half off.
There you go. And then are there any other the socials?
You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. That's Theater Diaspora. And yeah.
Okay. Well, we are really out of time now, so I just really want to give a very, very big thank you for all of you coming in this morning. We have actor, producer Samson Siroth, actress Andrea White, and, of course, the playwright of The Brothers Paranormal, Prince Gomavilas. Thank you so much for coming into Radio Zine.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, just remember, you can always hear this interview on our website, kboo.fm, or you can always go onto iTunes or Google Play to download this a little bit later. And yeah, remember, you can always learn more about this at Coho Productions website, cohoproductions.org. Also at Media Rights website there that was just mentioned by Samson. I'm Jenna Yokoyama. Thank you so much for tuning in this morning.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Nicholas Meyer, whose latest book is The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols, adapted from the journals of John H. Watson, M.D., which means it's a Sherlock Holmes book. He is the author of 7% Solution, The West End Horror, The Canary Trainer. Those are three Sherlock Holmes books, pastiches. There's three other novels, two books of nonfiction, including a memoir, View from the Bridge, which I interviewed you about a decade or more, somewhere in there ago.
Yes.
Also a director of Wrath of Khan, The Undiscovered Country, also Time After Time, TV film The Day After. Also was in the writer's room, I guess, of Star Trek Discovery.
First year,
which we'll get to. Also wrote the pilot, I understand, of the TV series Time After Time.
I did not. What I did do is I'm a co-creator of Medici's Masters of Florence, and I worked on the first season. And at that time, the company that makes it is an Italian company called Lux Vidae. If you know your Latin, that means I see the light. And Lux Vidae is a, they make sort of costume period stuff. So they got involved with the Medici and my partner and me, Frank Spotnitz, who also created The Man in the High Castle. And the folks at Lux Vidae were content to fly over an American and put up with him and put him up for the first season. But afterwards they said, oh, we now figure out how you do this. Oh, you can go home now.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah. Going into its third season. And I did the two-night Houdini with Adrian Brody for the History Channel.
Well, before we get into these nooks and crannies, including Star Trek Discovery, let's talk about The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols. First, what brought you back into writing another Sherlock Holmes book?
Well, that's a question that's sort of hard to pin down in terms of a response. The idea came first. I have always been interested in forgeries. I have a little library of forgery, whether it's art forgery or literary forgery or musical forgery. I'm fascinated by it, possibly because technically, I suppose, I'm a forger myself, because I forged these Watson manuscripts, which are in turn forgeries by Arthur Conan Doyle. So I come by my interest in forgery naturally. It isn't very long, if you study forgery, before you come across the most vicious and destructive forgery probably of all time, which is something that some of your readers will, listeners will know and others won't, called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. And this document, which is about 300 pages, was first put out on an unsuspecting world in around 1903 by the Tsar's secret police, the Okhrana. And what the Protocols of the Elders of Zion purports to be are the minutes of a secret meeting of Jews plotting to take over the world. And although the protocols are sort of ridiculous and were very early on debunked, there are, unsurprisingly, many quarters of the world to this day which circulate them, disseminate them as being truthful. And among other things, they're taught in textbooks in many places in the Middle East. Some places in Louisiana have also been documented. Vladimir Putin has quoted the protocols. In the 1920s, Henry Ford published the complete protocols of the Elders of Zion in his newspaper, the Dearborn Independent. And this is not a small paper. It doesn't exist anymore. But at the time he published these notorious and rather nauseating pages, it had the largest circulation of any newspaper in the United States except the Daily News. So it was not a small thing that he did in circulating this libel, I don't know what else to call it. And so I came across the protocols. If you Google them, you'll come across them. You just type it in. And seeing as they came about in about 1903, I don't know where the idea popped into my head, but it was a long time ago. It's at least 10 years ago. What if Sherlock Holmes was put up against the protocols of the learned elders of Zion? And could I, you know, they say, set a thief to catch a thief. Could I, as a forger, set out and catch a forger, maybe approaching this from a more oblique angle than another straight-on refutation of this thing that simply refuses to die? So after thinking about it for 10 years, I finally got around to it.
Nicholas Meyer, when you started getting around to it, was it hard to get back into Watson's voice? Was that kind of like the easiest thing?
You know, I think Watson's voice is practically my voice by this point. It's just, I started reading the Sherlock Holmes stories when my father gave me a one-volume complete edition. I must have been about 11, and I'm not a very fast reader. In fact, I'm a very slow reader, but my recollection is that it more or less took over my life. There are 60 stories, 56 short ones and 4 novellas. And they're not, you know, it's a little confusing because the first one, A Study in Scarlet, which is how Sherlock meets Watson, when you're halfway through the story, remember, I'm 11 years old, you turn the page and suddenly you're in Utah. I thought, what? This is, I didn't even know what a printer's mistake was, but I was convinced I'd experienced one, that they've glued the two wrong books together. Because there's no transition, there's no explanation. I'm in Utah with Mormons. And then it all sort of comes full circle. I mean, I just kept reading. I didn't know what else to do. So that was my first rather memorable. And Sherlock Holmes got me interested in many things. It got me interested in Mormons when I drove across country from New York to seek my fortune in California in the movie business. I had to go to Salt Lake. I had to see the Mormons because I had read A Study in Scarlet. And later on, The Sign of the Four, I got interested in the Indian Mutiny of 1857. Later on, I got interested in cocaine because the guy was shooting up. And I thought, what is that? Or you read about the mafia, you read about interracial marriage. It's like a lay Bible. It covers everything, those 60 stories.
What brought you to 7% Solution? By that point, I mean, a number of people had been writing Holmes' pastiches ever since Doyle died.
Yes, life's darkest hours when you finish the last book and you go, now what? I moved out to California in 1971, and I stumbled on to what is called the writings about the writings. And this is Sherlock Holmes and women, Sherlock Holmes and music, Sherlock Holmes and Japanese baritsu fighting, and all kind of arcane stuff. No one was reading this stuff except me. And I read an essay that my father gave. Well, I should back up. My father was a psychoanalyst. And people would say to me in high school, oh, your old man's a shrink. Is he a Freudian? And I didn't know. So I said, Pop, are you a Freudian? And he said, it's a silly question. And I said, why is it a silly question? And he said, because it is no more possible to discuss the history of psychoanalysis and not start with Freud than it is to discuss the history of the Western discovery of America and not start with Columbus or the Vikings, take your pick. But to suppose that nothing has happened since the Vikings is to be pretty doctrinaire, pretty rigid. When a patient comes to see me, he went on, I look at what they're wearing. I'm interested if they're on time. I listen to what they're saying. I listen to how they say it. I am especially curious as to what they are not saying. I am, in short, searching for clues from them as to why they're not happy. And I said, gee, that sounds like detective work, what you do. And he said, well, it is kind of like detective work. And then a little light bulb went off in my head. Maybe I'm 13 or 14. And I thought, gee, I wonder how much Arthur Conan Doyle knew about the life and writing of Sigmund Freud. And almost the first thing you realize is, oh, they're both doctors. Oh, and they died in the same city within 9 years of each other. And then Holmes is a cocaine addict, and Freud, for a time, was also a cocaine addict. And as I say, I think very slowly, I read very slowly. If I talk fast, I'm giving you a tape. But over a bunch of years, I kept adding to my Freud-Holmes thing, and at first I thought it was going to be nonfiction, and then I thought, no, I don't know how to do that. I'm a storyteller, or I'm nothing. And so then it was Sherlock Holmes meets Sigmund Freud, and an exchange of values takes place. Freud helps Holmes get off his coke habit, and in return, Holmes exposes Freud to those methods of deductive reasoning that set Freud on the path to psychoanalysis.
And that's how, and that's how 7% solution started.
Long-winded answer, but
You wound up writing two more. And at the same time, you were also working in the Star Trek universe. The one thing they have in common is what's kind of called the canon, meaning everything has to fit within the universe that's already been pre-established.
Yes, correct.
Going back to Adventure of Peculiar Protocols, how worried were you about that?
Well, there are, as you say, established chronologies. By the way, all the Holmes chronologies don't necessarily agree. Many years ago, a man named William Baring Gould did the first annotated Sherlock Holmes stories. And he established what he thought was his chronology, and I more or less accepted that at face value. Now, another annotator, who happens to be a very close friend, Les Klinger, whose endorsement I believe is on the back of the book, he made a different annotated two-volume thing, and he's also annotated H.P. Lovecraft and Mary Shelley and a whole, he's in the annotating business. So there are arguments, but I was satisfied that 1905 was a more or less empty year. There are other vacancies in the Holmes chronology. The principal vacancy, as you and your listeners may be aware, is that when Holmes and Moriarty fall to their deaths, presumably over the Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland, Holmes goes on the run. In real time, it's 3 years. In Doyle's life, it's 10 years, because it took him that long to get back to writing any more of them. And then Holmes says, and here's where I was during those years when I was on the run from the professor's minions. And he says, you know, I was in Tibet. I was doing this. I was doing that. And of course, that's a field day.
And then the idea of placing this in 1905. Does Doyle talk about the post-Moriarty years specifically? Do we know what years those were? Or is that really vague?
It's not vague. People have, as I say, pieced this all together, and yeah, they may disagree in some particulars, but the clues are sort of scanty. You know, at some point Holmes is retired, but we know he was still active, as of 1914, because he had been doing undercover work against the German spy von Bork for 2 years in America under the name Altmont.
And those are Doyle
those
stories.
That's Doyle's story. His I think that's his last bow. And after which, he retired to Sussex to keep bees, as we all know. He was a beekeeper. Don't ask, because Doyle just dreamt this stuff up and just spewed it out. One day he said, gee, we need to mix this up a little bit. Let's give him an older brother. And suddenly Mycroft, we haven't heard about him for, any of the other stories, and suddenly there he is.
You're listening to an interview with Nicholas Meyer, whose latest novel is The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. In the Holmes canon, where does 1905 fit?
The superficial answer is quite easily. I don't think there are stories that date in this period. And I checked with Les Klinger when I wrote the manuscript. I said, am I good here? And he said, oh, yeah, you're in the clear. So I put together certain elements. One is we know that Watson remarried after the death of his first wife, Mary Morstan. But we never really know to whom he was married. It's another one of Doyle's throwaway lines. So I decided to give him a second wife. He's resumed his practice, which there are other references to the fact that he's resumed his medical practice. So I gave him that, and because the protocols were disseminated or discovered or released or forged or whatever you want in 1903, I thought I could sort of be flexible chronologically and say 1905 because it worked better for other reasons, because the first Russian Revolution took place in 1905.
There's a character, a major character named Anna Strunsky, which when I saw the name, my eyes picked up because actually I interviewed her nephew. I'm getting a look.
This is me with my jaw falling out. Yeah, that's amazing. Tell me about this, please.
Anna Strunsky had a brother, and I don't remember his name. Brother had kids, one of whom was Lenore and the other of whom was English. Lenore married Ira Gershwin. English in the 1920s hung out with George Gershwin. So when I was doing some work on a Gershwin documentary, I interviewed English. I didn't know of Anna Strunsky, who she was, but she was pretty famous in her day. And she and her husband established the NAACP.
With William Du Bois, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of them together. And it was founded in their Central Park West apartment.
What brought you to bring Anna Strunsky into the story?
There's a professor named Steven Zipperstein, who is at Stanford. And he wrote a nonfiction book called Pogrom. And Pogrom is about the massacre at this town that Holmes goes to.
Kishinev.
And I think it was in that book that I came across Anna Strunsky and Edward English Walling as a couple. And I thought, oh, and the year is right. 1905, they were there. So that's how it happened.
Nicholas Meyer, Star Trek Discovery, how did you get involved? What was your input? And then you left after the first season. What happened?
Well, when my agent, Alan Gasmer, heard that they were gearing up for this, he contacted what we call the powers that be and said, you guys should have Nick as part of the writing team. And I met a man named Brian Fuller who was running the show. And he hired me. He was a very nice man. And I worked on it for this first year, and I was assigned to write the second episode. I hadn't really been, with the exception of the Medicis in England, in the writer's room of a television show. So I really didn't have anything to compare it to in terms of how this was supposed to work. But increasingly, I became concerned because we didn't seem to be turning out any scripts. I don't wish to be indiscreet, and I shouldn't be. But I can tell you that people came and went on the show runners and and it, it was like many new enterprises had a sort of shaky maiden voyage. It's not like we hit an iceberg, but I think we dodged a few in the creation of the television series. Then new people were brought in, and there was turnover, and I was part of the turnover.
The last time I interviewed you, the first J.J. Abrams movie had come out, and you complained that it veered away from what Roddenberry was actually trying to do, which is have something deeper than just an adventure story. I don't know if that's your feeling today, but when looking at Discovery, was that in the back of your mind at all?
I don't think it was. I know J.J. very well. I used to read J.J. bedtime stories. That's how long I did the Houdini miniseries with his dad, with Jerry Abrams, who's been a friend of mine since 1973. And in fact, Small World Department, I bumped into J.J., who's a lovely man, by the way, in the Fox Commissary, I don't know, 15 years ago. I bump into him from time to time, but he came up to me and he said, "Do you remember what you gave me for my bar mitzvah?" And I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "You gave me the annotated Sherlock Holmes, which my son is reading now." So it's the gift that kept on giving. Sherlock Holmes is the gateway drug. Anyway, no, I wasn't thinking about him when I was involved in this television series. I guess I was excited and ultimately sort of bewildered by how television works and the fact that, you know, it's sort of writing by committee.
Did the arc of the story, which involves the Captain Lorca, was that at the beginning? I mean, were you part of that, or were you just more mapping things out? Not to give away those who haven't seen it, but the ending is a huge switch on who Lorca is.
I'm not competent to really say, for various reasons, including spoilers and stuff. I just know that he was part of the first, and you know, I don't know that I've watched the part with the big switch, so I can't speak to that.
You stopped watching it?
Well, I was never really watching it. I was just working on it. It's like saying, "Do you read your own books?" And I go, "No, I can't get through them." It's funny about this whole thing about sort of seeing one's own. I've talked to directors about, "Do you like watching your own movies?" And most of the time, not so much. All you see is, "Oh, I didn't get that shot. I didn't film this correctly."
How do you feel about your own work as a director? Can you ever go back and look? Because then it might go, "Oh, damn, I missed that."
Oh, I went through that phase years ago. Let me put it this way. I didn't direct The 7% Solution. I wrote the screenplay. Herb Ross directed it. And while I thought there were many really terrific things in the movie, I was also very aware of my own shortcomings as a screenwriter. I became a much better screenwriter when I started to direct. And I say this notwithstanding what people will say, "But your screenplay was nominated for an Oscar." Yeah, yeah. But I still could see all the things I did wrong. And over time, a sort of calcified conviction became mine that the movie was not good or not very good. And then about 10 years ago, 11 years ago, I found myself in an auditorium with a whole bunch of people watching a brand new print of the movie, which I had not seen in years. And I hadn't intended to stay. I was supposed to introduce it and then go someplace. But as it happened, there was no place to go. I was on a college campus in February. It was snowing outside, and there was no coffee shop. So I sat and watched, and I was amazed at how good this movie was. Simply amazed. You know what Hamlet says, there is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so.
Is it different than, say, watching a film you directed and worked on the editing on?
Well, I watched time after time, and I can see all the things I've done wrong. It was the first movie I ever directed. I can see all the errors that I made, and yet it is very evident, even to me, that this is a wonderful movie of enormous charm and cleverness, and it holds up very well.
And the three Star Trek films? Well, you only directed two of them.
So. I directed two and six. You know, when I came on to Star Trek, I didn't know anything about Star Trek. I'd never seen it. I, when it was a kid and it was on TV, it looked like a lot of people running around in Dr. Denton's, and I just dialed it. I missed everything that was important about it. I missed the interracial and international characters. I missed all the analogies, all the metaphors. So I sort of struck off in my own direction when I did Star Trek II. I said, okay, this is Captain Horatio Hornblower in outer space. That's what this is. This is a submarine movie. There's a movie I love called The Enemy Below with Robert Mitchum and Kurt Juergens, directed by Dick Powell, of all people. And that was my model. The best thing I can say about the things that I've done, or the best of them, not all of them, but the best of them, is they seemed like they were built to last. With all their faults and flaws, they hold up.
Well, that's what I noticed in looking on IMDb. I mean, there were a couple I didn't recognize, but most of them are pretty well-known works, whether it be...
There are a couple of screamers in there. But
Yeah, but you know, time after time, the Star Trek films, Prince of Egypt, of all things.
Yeah, my animated movie.
Do you ever plan to direct another movie?
Well, I ain't a kid anymore. I know I sound like a kid. It takes a lot of energy to do it. It would have to be something I could really sort of get my arms around. But sure, I'd love to do it again. As Orson Welles said, it's the biggest set of electric trains any kid was ever given to play with.
Which movie was the most fun to make?
Probably it's a toss-up between... Time After Time and The Wrath of Khan. Time After Time was enormously fun because I had no idea what I was doing. I'd directed stage plays, I'd directed radio plays, but I never directed a movie. And Herb Jaffe and his son Steve saw to it that there was a red carpet constantly being unfurled with every step I took. And it was wonderful fun. I made all kind of mistakes, but I was having the time of my life. That was enormous fun. And I was watching Malcolm and Mary Steenburgen, they were falling in love in front of me. I thought, you're a really good director. I had no idea what was really going on.
And the Star Trek one was fun too then.
Oh yeah, it was. Yeah, it was fun because, among other things, Paramount was in such disarray at the time, and they were so busy with other things that they paid no attention to me whatever. And I really sort of got to do all the things that I wanted to do with it. It was a lot of fun.
That's what was so great about The Wire. Apparently, HBO had nothing else, so they said they just left the people to do what they wanted. And I guess that's when it's
brilliance.
The most fun.
Yeah. And arguably when you get some really good results.
Nicholas Meyer, what are you working on now?
Well, I just finished the second draft of a screenplay for a couple of producers who've raised a good deal of money. It's a big action adventure film, which is a true story, but in the best tradition of The Guns of Navarone, it's a popcorn chomping thrill ride, and the fact that it's true really, I think, adds a special zest or zing to it.
Do you have in the back of your mind any more Sherlock Holmes?
Funnily enough, for a person who hasn't written one in 26 years, my agent suggested something, and I thought, well, now that is interesting. But I haven't had time to get around to it yet.
You've been listening to an interview with Nicholas Meyer, whose latest novel, which is Sherlock Holmes' novel, is The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols. The Medicis, which you worked on, is on Netflix.
It is, season 3.
I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. An extended version of this interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
This is KBOO Portland. We are crawling up to the 12 noon hour, at which time you will be regaled with approximately 90 minutes of folk roots Americana. Mm-hmm. With your host, the one and only, the inimitable, and what a guy, Don Jacobson. That's coming up right after this, so stay tuned for an entire afternoon of the best music you will hear in this and any other universe.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, featuring a special appearance by Radim Zenkel. The show is Friday, November 1st, 7:30 p.m., at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Radim Zenkel created what he calls Zenkel-style mandolin, where his single instrument can sound like two. He plays his native Czech music, along with bluegrass, classical, jazz, and much more. He was named U.S. Mandolin Champion in 1992. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of TEDx Mount Hood 2019 on Saturday, November 2nd from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Roosevelt Theater in Portland. The 9th annual TEDx event features talks and performances by community members, including advocate for homeless families Brandy Tuck, creative architect D'Angelo Rains, Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, and many more. There will also be coffee, tea, breakfast items, and lunch. Again, that's TEDx Mount Hood 2019 on Saturday, November 2nd from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Roosevelt Theater, 6941 North Central Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge.